books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we have a return visit from Fiona Lucas, talking about her new book, Always and Only You. Plus, we'll take a dive into the RNIB library to find some new biographies, one of which is written and read by Al Pacino. All that and more on today's Read On. Today, we're welcoming back Fiona Lucas. Her new emotional and unforgettable love story of 2024 is Always and Only You. Erin is about to marry the love of her life. She and Simon have been together for 8 years, so it feels right that they're finally tying the knot. It's been stressful balancing the demands of friends and family, not to mention Simon's difficult best man, Gil. But Erin couldn't be happier. Couldn't be happier, that is, until she walks down the aisle and finds the wrong man waiting for her. But is the universe playing a cruel trick on Erin, or could it be that her perfect life isn't quite what she imagined? I spoke to Fiona a few weeks back before the audio version was recorded, and we'll have that interview in a moment, but for now, the audio version of Always and Only You was narrated by Sophia Engstrand.
I walk onto the dance floor and a cheer goes up. I play the part, smiling, holding the bouquet above my head like a trophy to be won, even though I'm dreading what's coming next. Gathered in the middle of the dance floor are 20 to 30 women, most eyeing my bouquet up with hunger. Some have a, "What the heck, this'll be a laugh," glimmer in their eyes, and they elbow their friends and pretend to do warm-up exercises. Some are definitely not single, and are there under false pretenses. Anjali joins the end of the loose semicircle. Instinctively, I know she's placed herself there, so there won't be too many competing pairs of arms. She catches my eye and gives me a meaningful look. I turn and grip the bouquet with both hands. After a couple of moments of stillness, I breathe in deeply and mentally picture where Anjali is standing. One, two, I make a little dip to get a better swing, and then three. I squeeze my eyes shut and send it flying up and over my head. I turn round to track its progress and see that there, right beside my maid of honour, is Simon. There's a moment of complete hush where all other eyes in the room are trained on the floral missile. But he locks his on me. I hold my breath as Gil and I watch to see where it lands. There's no larking around now. Women jostle, rise onto their toes, straining just to get a millimetre closer. One of my tall cousins is right behind Anjali, ready to intercept the bouquet with her long arms. But Taryn grabs for it a split second too late, and another hand shoots out and wraps around the ribbon-bound stems. Not Anjali's, but Simon's.
So we're welcoming back today a friend of the show, Fiona Lucas. You've been on twice. Last we chatted about Never Forget You. So this time, tell us about Always and Only You.
Well, this was a book I pitched a ton of different ideas to my editor, and I really only had one sentence to go on when I started, or one and a half sentences, which was, what would you do if you walked down the aisle on your wedding day and the wrong man was waiting for you and nobody else just seemed to think anything was out of place? That's what I started with.
She spins around to see who robbed her of her rightful prize, ready to put up a fight. But when she sees who it is, she falters. He does a gallant little bow and hands it to her. She holds it up triumphantly, beaming at everyone and shooting me a "you almost blew it" look.
Then she turns back to Simon to thank him. But Simon isn't looking at her. He's looking at me. And when he sees Gil slide a possessive arm around my waist, his expression hardens, and he wraps his arms around Anjali and pulls her into an enthusiastic kiss. More cheering, even louder than before. Because it's what everyone roots for at a wedding, isn't it? The best man and the maid of honour finding romance? What could be more perfect? What could be more terrible?
We spoke last time about Never Forget You. Are there echoes of Amnesia in this book?
Well, kind of. I suppose it depends. There's an element of kind of a medical condition, but not necessarily. Amnesia can be associated with it, but it's not the main part of it, if you know what I mean. So my main character has a serious head injury. So there's a little bit of trauma, brain trauma and things going on as part of that. One of the most fascinating bits was some of the research I did. So I'm going to have to give a few spoilers away here, is that I needed to find a reason why my main character might end up thinking she was getting married to someone else and maybe almost having a bit of an alternate life for a few chapters. And I came across a TikTok actually that Richard Hammond did, talking about, and the Top Gear presenter, talking about being in hospital after he had a massive crash in a jet propelled car. I've read his biography about it since, his memoir about it since. And he was talking about, he was unaware, he was unconscious. He was just walking through a favourite place in the Lake District, enjoying the view. And he approached a certain tree and he started to feel like, I'm going to be in trouble if I go any further past this tree. I feel like I really shouldn't go that far, that I need to turn back. And it wasn't long after that he woke up from his coma. And what he didn't know is his wife had been told it was looking pretty dicey and that she should prepare for the worst. And she asked the doctors, can I shout at him? And they said, yeah, well, do, you know, try anything. So she just shouted at him and swore at him and told him, don't you dare leave me, you better flipping well wake up. And he woke up and he believes that sense of you know, that he was in trouble was because part of his brain was processing his wife shouting at him. And it reminded me of a story a friend of mine had. She had quite a significant stroke in 2012. While she wasn't actually in a coma, as far as she was concerned, she was having a lovely cruise round. She went to St. Lucia, Nigeria, and then Australia and New Zealand. And it felt utterly real to her, didn't feel like a dream or anything. And when she put her key in her front door, when she got home and turned the key, she woke up and found herself in hospital. And that's when she kind of became conscious. And this, I then started researching this idea of what happens sometimes to our brain. It takes us to different places, maybe when there's something traumatic going on. And maybe that was a good explanation for what was happening to my character. So researching that was absolutely fascinating. The more I researched, the more fascinating it got. People had like 20-year lives. They thought they'd live somewhere else while they'd been unconscious, or invented whole towns that they lived in and went to coffee and went to work. And you know, but it's rare, but it happens enough that it's not completely unknown. So
one question I was going to ask, I was thinking about Gil. At the start of the book, she finds him quite difficult. How do you turn the reader's opinion of a difficult character around?
I did some sneaky things where, although the book is first person, I've got like a timeline going on in the past, which reveals a little bit more about who he is and what he's thinking, even if you're not getting his perspective in the present day. And that was my little secret weapon to kind of make readers fall in love with him even before, hopefully, my character did.
When I talked to you about Never Forget You, you said that your multiple timelines for a bit of a nightmare to write. You're not making life easy for yourself.
No, I seem to, every time I say, I'm not going to do another book like this. And then comes the idea. And now I'm trying to work out how to tell a book where I'm only doing one day a year. And then I've got to try and work out what happened the first time. Is it going to have the same thing going to happen this time? And how does it all kind of fit together to take me where I started the book at year 10? Yeah, I probably should try and make life easier for myself, but I don't seem to be able to.
I'm picturing a cork board with post-it notes and little threads going across it, things.
I've got one of those, yes.
I'm watching my best friend and the man I love making out right in front of my face. Someone yells, "Get a room!" And everyone laughs. But I don't laugh. I want to be sick. I want to look away. But I can't seem to make my body follow the instructions my brain is giving it. I'm frozen. And when Simon's hand smooths down Anjali's back to cup her bottom, I feel vomit in the back of my mouth. I look away and see Gil staring. He's just as astonished as I am. "You said we were out of here the moment the bouquet toss was done?" I manage to croak out. He nods. "Then let's get out of here."
And we'll have more from Fiona Lucas after this.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. What happens in the Talking Book Studios when the narrator makes a mistake?
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted him to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long, one side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios will come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in out the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And I've been reading for RNIB, blah, blah. How's that? Does that work?
The new digital Bookingtook?
Bookingtook, yeah. It's Bookingtook. A new word.
I enjoyed doing this sort of thing for its own sake, and if...
Damn. Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now on Read On, let's find some great new biographies in the RNIB library. Here's Lynn Livingston.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
From Penguin Random House, we received We All Shine On, John, Yoko and Me by Elliot Mintz.
I am holding in my hands a pair of eyeglasses. They are antique, made of steel wire and perfectly round. Some people used to call them granny glasses, although this pair's trademark name is the Panto 45, originally manufactured by an old English eyewear company called Alga Works. I don't have it in me to try them on. That would somehow cross a line. So instead, I just hold them up to my eyes and peer through the lenses from arm's length. But even without slipping them onto my nose, they tell me something about John Lennon's view of the world that I'd never really thought much about while he was alive. His vision was terrible, even worse than I'd ever thought. This is the 26th pair of John's glasses I've examined on this snowy night in February 1981. It has been about 2 months since he was gunned down in New York City, outside the Dakota, the now 140-year-old brick and sandstone Gothic edifice on West 72nd Street and Central Park West, where he and Yoko Ono had been living since 1973.
A personal and revealing look at the last 10 years of John Lennon's life and his partnership with Yoko Ono, written by the friend who knew them best, publicist and music industry insider Elliot Mintz. From the moment he interviewed Yoko Ono on his late-night radio show in September 1971, Elliot Mintz's life would never be the same again. That phone call would lead him to an intense, revealing friendship with Yoko and her husband John Lennon, until John's untimely death in 1980 and beyond to the present day. In 1971, then a talk show host on the American airwaves, Elliot Mintz was talking to all the major figures in the burgeoning West Coast music scene when he was asked whether he would interview Yoko about her new album. Their talk quickly led to other private calls, and then to John Lennon, with whom he quickly formed a firm bond. Those conversations became hours-long epics, to the extent that Elliot had another phone line put in, for which only two people had the number, John and Yoko.
I've been tasked with the responsibility of inventorying his personal effects. Books, wallets, attaché cases, drawings, letters, artworks, photos, musical instruments, and yes, granny glasses, of which he had dozens of pairs in a rainbow of tinted colors, so that Yoko and posterity would know precisely what he had left behind. Most of this heartbreaking work, which fills weeks of my life, is performed between midnight and 6 a.m, the hours during which I am least likely to be disturbed by the small army of assistants and other staffers who buzz around John and Yoko's multiple apartments at the Dakota, much of it taking place in the building's crypt-like sub-basement. It's the dead of winter, and there's no heating in this underground catacomb, which once served as the Dakota's stables back when New York was a horse and buggy town, but which in more recent years has been converted into storage stalls for its well-to-do tenants.
We All Shine On, John, Yoko and Me, by Elliot Mintz, is read by the author and lasts for 9 hours, 10 minutes.
Penguin Random House gave us the autobiography of Al Pacino called Sonny Boy, a memoir.
I have written a memoir. I thought I never would. Naturally, I hope you enjoy it. I've always been comfortable being a private person. Of course, writing a book and talking about one's life, or let's say parts of one's life, is in and of itself an invitation. Like you're opening the door and asking everyone to come on in. I've had a long life, and I've tried to cover some of it here and give you a general idea of the kind of road I've traveled. It's been pretty twisty, turny, and there's a few bumps along the way. I'm still on that road, as a matter of fact. I hope you have a good time, and I thank you for your interest.
To the wider world, Al Pacino exploded onto the scene like a supernova. He landed his first leading role in The Panic in Needle Park in 1971, and by 1975 he'd starred in 4 movies, The Godfather, The Godfather Part 2, Serpico, and Dog Day Afternoon. They were not just successes, but landmarks in the history of film. Those performances became legendary and changed his life forever. Not since Marlon Brando and James Dean in the late 50s had an actor landed in the culture with such force. But Pacino was in his mid-30s by then and had already lived several lives. A fixture of avant-garde theatre in New York, he had led a bohemian existence, working odd jobs to support his craft. He was raised by a fiercely loving but mentally unwell mother and her parents after his father left them when he was young. But in a real sense, he was raised by the streets of the South Bronx and by the troupe of buccaneering young friends he ran with, whose spirits never left him. After a teacher recognised his acting promise and pushed him towards New York's fabled Hive School of Performing Arts, the die was cast. In good times and bad, in poverty and wealth and in poverty again, Through pain and joy, acting was his lifeline, his community, his tribe. Sonny Boy is the memoir of a man who has nothing left to fear and nothing left to hide. All the great roles, the essential collaborations, and the important relationships are given their full due, as is the vexed marriage between creativity and commerce at the highest levels. The book's golden thread, however, is the spirit of love and purpose.
For years, the old Ellesmere Theatre on Crotona Parkway in the Bronx was one of the places I went to watch films. They called these buildings movie palaces for a reason. They were ornate beyond belief. The sculpted faces stuck out of the walls and chandeliers dangled high above your head. The curtains and the carpets gleamed with red and golden hues. Just setting foot inside such a place for a few hours was enough to take you away from the drab daily life. And then, when I was 15 years old, I saw something there I'd never seen before. As if they arrived straight out of some bygone century, a troupe of actors came, put on a production of The Seagull by Anton Chekhov. The theater seated nearly 2,000 people, and an audience of about 15 came to see the play. Maybe 20, if I'm being generous. But two of those audience members were my friend Bruce and me.
Sonny Boy, a memoir by Al Pacino, is read by Al Pacino and runs for 12 hours and 29 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now let's return to Fiona Lucas. The audio version of her book, Always and Only You, is read by Sophia Engstrand.
A sudden jab of pain causes me to pull my hand sharply away from my bouquet of white tea roses, mixed with ferns and eucalyptus. A tiny red bead bulges on the pad of my index finger before a drop of blood falls onto the skirt of my wedding dress. There aren't supposed to be any thorns, I think, as I jam my fingertip against the ribbon bound tightly around the stems. I glance at the crimson teardrop on the off-white taffeta and swear. My father, who is staring straight ahead at the closed church doors, turns to look at me. Everything okay? I want to let my lip wobble. No, everything is not okay. I've dreamed of this day for so long, and I want everything to be perfect. I peel my finger off my bouquet and inspect it. The dark speck of a puncture wound is the only evidence on my body, but the pristine white ribbon is now a smeary red mess. Everything's fine, I say out loud, because if I say it, it will make it so. And everything is fine. I'm getting married to Simon today. It's day one of our perfect life together. That's all that matters.
Another echo from the book Never Forget You is the fact that there's a second chance involved in this book. Is that something you return to again and again?
Sometimes it just depends on the story, really, as to whether it goes that way. This one, there's a bit more of a love. Actually, there was a love triangle and Never Forget You. So yes, there's a bit of a love triangle going on. So my character's kind of about to get married to someone and then things all go a bit haywire. And then she's left questioning whether she's making the right choice.
So there'll be a bit of a timey-wimey thing going on here. At the point of the recording of this interview, we're still in October. So who is narrating the audio version?
Sophia Engstrand. She also narrated Never Forget You, and she did such a brilliant job that she was automatic top pick. My agent and I both said, yes, we think she'd be brilliant for this one as well.
As we wait for the church doors to swing open, and the strains of Pachelbel's Canon in D to begin, I can't help being aware of the almost unnoticeable stain on my skirt. I imagine it spreading, seeping through the weave of the fabric, until, by the time I reach the altar, my dress has transformed into one of deep red velvet. Behind me, my best friend, Anjali, fusses with the half train of my dress, fanning it out into a perfect semicircle. At least she's got that right.
Now, one thing we'd miss if we download the audiobook from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you describe the cover of Always and Only You for us?
I can do. It's considering it's coming out in November, it's not very Christmassy looking. It's got a pale pink background and sort of flowers with petals flying everywhere. I think it's supposed to look like a wedding bouquet that maybe has come apart slightly. And then there's large kind of dark pink writing saying Always and Only You.
Now, what I've been doing for research this morning is looking on your TikTok page where you run a bit of an authors group. How did that come out?
Well, I got on TikTok kind of early. It was my lockdown project. I think everyone else was baking and I got on TikTok. Well, along with a lot of young people, I felt very old to start off with. And it became more and more popular. So BookTok became more of a thing that is really influencing the publishing industry. So I had lots of authors saying to me, oh, I've got no idea what to do with TikTok. So I just set up a Facebook group and put some information in there and people come and ask questions and we chat about what's working, what's not working, what the algorithm's doing this week and trying to just cheer each other along a little bit.
Yeah, I've been looking at posts where you're encouraging people to write alongside you.
At the moment, I'm a bit up and down with the writing process at the moment. I'm not sure anyone should be following me.
That's it. Judging by the TikTok, you're much more of a plotter than a pantser.
I am. It's a strange thing. I have seen other people who work like me that where I'm about to write, I can normally, I've got lots of ideas and lots of detail for that. But further on in the book is a bit misty. I might know the main plot points, but I don't always know where the scene's going to take place or exactly what's going to happen. And things change quite a lot as I go along. So I suppose I'm a bit like a stepping stone plotter. I will have my major points plotted out and then I work out how to get to each one of them. So I'll have to stop and plan every few chapters to go, okay, where am I going next? And work out which characters are going to be involved and where they're going to be and what they're going to be talking about and doing. I can't always work that out right back at the beginning. I wish I could. It'd make things a lot easier.
Of course, you started as Fiona Harper writing Mills and Boone. Is that where that discipline comes from?
Yeah, I did have to be quite disciplined with Mills and Boone. I started off writing 2 a year, but I got up to 3 a year. And they're shorter books, but yeah, I had to keep working out, you know, where I was going. And I have to say, I join a Zoom a lot of mornings run by the London Writers Salon, who do international write together sessions at 8 o'clock at London time, New York time, Pacific Coast time, and Australia and New Zealand time. So you can join 4 different ones throughout the day. And it's really good to kind of turn up at 8 a.m. and just spend an hour writing with other people. No one's talking. We just get down to it. And that's been a really good discipline to kind of keep me plodding away at it every day.
It's amazing, I think, that you've written anything in the last year, because also on TikTok is the saga of your kitchen.
Yeah, I know. Oh, I think I'm laughing so I don't cry, actually. But yes, who knew? That's definitely been interrupting my writing process. In July 2023, I found a tiny crack in a water pipe in my kitchen and it had dripped behind all the cupboards and caused a lot of damp and mould behind the units that we hadn't discovered. And then cue a long-running insurance claim with the insurance company just not being very helpful at all. It took us almost a year to just get them to agree to settle anything. And then since then, we've also had extra problems, like the floor went down and it didn't go well. And now it's all got to come up again. And that's put us back by 2 months. I was living in a lovely rental accommodation, but the lease ended. So now I'm living back in my house, no kitchen, washing up in my bath. I have all the kitchen units and appliances piled up to the ceiling in my living room. And yeah, it's a little bit stressful, to say the least.
That's a genuine question. How are you still writing?
Last week, the London Writer Salon hours have been brilliant for that, to just kind of make me get up and get onto it. But this week, I've only managed about 500 words. And even when I've got time, my head has just been so busy and so stressed. But I have a deadline, so I'm going to have to work out how to do it somehow, because I don't want to be late.
Yeah, I don't know if you can talk about it, but what can we expect in book 30?
I've got a little bit of, it's kind of Groundhog Day meets One Day. So my main character has been married for 10 years, and on their anniversary party, her husband tells her he's had enough, he wants out. And then she then starts reliving her different wedding anniversaries, starting right back at the wedding day and then reliving each anniversary in turn, and then trying to work out how she can save her marriage in the process.
Hopefully Fiona will be back on the show to talk about that book, but for now, one last clip of Always and Only You by Fiona Lucas, narrated by Sophia Engstrand.
I'm ashamed to say, in my less charitable moments, I mentally refer to her as my maid of horror. I love her to bits, I really do. But in the 2 months running up to the wedding, her flat has flooded, she got herself embroiled in a sticky situation at work and almost got fired, and the sleazebag ex she can't seem to get over took out a non-molestation order against her. Not because she was actually stalking him, it was just a series of mishaps and misdialed numbers. The upshot of all that is, bit by bit, I've taken on almost all of her wedding-related tasks, and now her only jobs are to A, get my train looking good, and B, make sure the page boy and flower girl got dressed this morning and don't run riot through the ceremony. After that, it's their parents' job to wrangle them. I grip my bouquet harder, aware that my eyes feel scratchy. I thought I'd feel as light and joyous as a spring breeze waiting outside the church on my wedding day. But after weeks of planning and organising, it feels as if I've been running a marathon and I've just hit the wall. I can hardly wait until Simon and I can flop out like stranded jellyfish on sun lounges, sunning ourselves on a perfect white beach in... No. I blink to reset my mental slideshow. Stay here, Erin. Stay now. Because this moment will never come again. And it's the one you've been waiting for practically all your life.
Sophia Engstrand reading Always and Only You by Fiona Lucas. And Fiona Lucas, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been lovely to chat.
And Fiona will be back at the end of today's show with the books of her life.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hi, my name's Steve Hodson, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for, 35 years. It's been difficult to choose a favourite book. You can imagine in 35 years I've done an awful lot. Novels, biographies, autobiographies, poetry, all sorts of things. But one I do remember is a book called Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. It's a surreal and fantastical book about Satan paying a visit to Moscow. And it's full of weird and wacky creatures, more Satan's entourage of little devils. And it is absolutely bizarre.
Allow me to introduce you. Roland began, then interrupted himself. No, really. He looks too ridiculous. Just look what he has done to himself while he was under the bed. The cat, covered in dust and standing on its hind legs, bowed to Margarita. Round its neck, it was now wearing a made-up white bow tie on an elastic band, with a pair of ladies' mother-of-pearl binoculars hanging on a cord. It had also gilded its whiskers. "What have you done?" exclaimed Woland. "Why have you gilded your whiskers? And what on earth do you want with a white tie when you haven't even got any trousers?"
"Trousers don't suit cats, Messiah," replied the cat with great dignity.
"Sit down and stop all this hot air."
"Very well," replied the cat, sitting down. "But I must object. My remarks are by no means all hot air, as you so vulgarly put it. but a series of highly apposite syllogisms, which would be appreciated by such connoisseurs as Sextus Empiricus, Marcion Capella, even, who knows, Aristotle himself.
Check, said Woland. Check it is, rejoined the cat, surveying the chessboard through his lorgnette. So, Woland turned to Margarita. Let me introduce my retinue. That creature who has been playing the fool is the cat Behemoth. Azaziello and Kuroviev you have already met. This is my maid, Hella. She is prompt, clever, and there's no service she cannot perform for you. A charming and select little band.
It is a thinly veiled critique of Stalinist Russia. No wonder Stalin didn't like Mikhail Bulgakov. I love this writer anyway. I've done a couple of his plays because he also worked at Moscow Arts Theatre. And I like his work a lot. But it stands out in my mind because not long ago I was phoned with the help of the BBC. A young man got in touch with me and said he and his girlfriend were listening to Master and Margarita together and that they both loved it. But it was going to be her birthday the following week. And he was taking her down to Dorset. And at a certain time on her birthday, they were going to be walking along a beach there. And he asked me to phone him at that time. He would hand his phone to his girlfriend, and he wanted me to sing Happy Birthday in the voice I'd used for Satan in The Master and Margarita, which I did. I wish you could have heard her giggles. It was a lot of fun. Apparently they went out and had a very good lunch and far too much red wine afterwards. But it's lovely to be invited to do things like that. Just because you've recorded a book. Thanks for listening to Talking Books. It's been my pleasure.
And now let's take our second visit to the RNIB Library for some brand new biographies.
Midnight Express by Billy Hayes.
Some 12 miles west of Istanbul, beyond the outskirts of the city in the flat farm country near the coast, is Yeşilköy International Airport. Every day at noon, Pan American Flight No. 1 arrives from Tehran. It sorts out its incoming and outgoing passengers, then takes off again at 1 to continue its journey to Frankfurt, London, and New York. On the 6th of October, 1970, feeling like an Ian Fleming character, with dark aviator sunglasses over my eyes and my trench coat collar pulled up to my ears, I watched Flight No. 1, a Boeing 707, land on the concrete runway. I pulled the brim of my lucky hat low over my eyes and eased up against the wall near the passenger check-in counter. A short, pudgy man in his mid-30s pushed past me and heaved his suitcase onto the scale. A good-looking, dark-haired girl behind the counter tagged his bag, stamped his ticket, and waved him through to the security checkpoint. From where I stood, I could see the balding spot on his head, flush with effort, as he walked down the long corridor. There, at the end, a bored Turkish officer in a rumpled uniform half-heartedly looked into the carry-on bag and glanced at the man's passport. Coughing on his cigarette, the guard waved the passenger on his way. I watched the pudgy man disappear into the Pan Am passenger lounge. Yes, yes, I assured myself. That's the way. It looks easy.
For Billy Hayes, 1970 was a horrifying year. It was the year when he tried to smuggle 4 pounds of hashish from Istanbul back to his home in America. It was the year when he was arrested at Istanbul Airport, tried and sentenced to 30 years in a Turkish jail. For 5 years he suffered the filth, brutality and degradation of imprisonment in an environment of hellish squalor, while his family fought in vain to secure his release. Finally, in desperation, he made a daring escape bid, and incredibly, the bid succeeded. This is the astounding true story told in Billy Hayes' own words of those 5 years of living hell, and of the harrowing ordeal of his time on the run. Vivid and realistic without being morbid, it is a classic story of survival and human endurance, told with humour, intelligence and total honesty.
I stepped up to the counter and with the last of my money bought a ticket to New York for the following day. I'd planned to watch the flight actually depart, but what more was there to see? Did I really need to be that thorough? Security here seemed to be a joke, almost an afterthought. If I hurried into a cab, I could make it back to the pudding shop in time for my date with that English girl I'd met at breakfast. She said she was in Istanbul studying belly dancing. I really didn't care if her story was true. All I wanted was some company before my adventure. That afternoon, that night, tomorrow, all seemed like scenes from a movie. And I, a little jittery, but trying my best to stay calm, was the leading man.
Midnight Express by Billy Hayes is read by John Chancellor and runs for 9 hours and 50 minutes.
The final book from Sven-Göran Eriksson. It's called A Beautiful Game and it was donated by Penguin Random House.
In Torsby, as in most communities in the Swedish countryside, it was important to stand with both feet on the ground, not to think that you were better or more worthy than anybody else. And preferably, those feet should meet the ground via the grass of a football pitch, the running tracks of a sports ground, or ski boots. Because in the Torsby of my childhood, in the 1950s and 1960s, everything centred on sports. At Bjørnevi Sports Ground, blue and white Torsby IF played their home matches, and they still do. To us children, the arena seemed gigantic, with the PA speakers blaring music before matches and at half-time. But football wasn't the only sport. The local high-jump star, Kjell Åke Nilsson, practiced his diving style in the evenings until darkness fell. But we also looked out over the larger world of sports, which came to northern Värmland with the help of radio and, of course, newsstands, like the one where Mum worked, selling magazines like Record Magazinet, Idrottsbladet, and Allsport.
Life is a beautiful game, but how should you play it? For Sven-Göran Eriksson, one of the world's most revered and respected football managers, the game has come to an end. He leaves us with these parting reflections, looking back on what he's achieved, experienced and learned over a lifetime in service to the beautiful game. It is a journey that has taken him from a small club in his native Sweden, across every continent, to competing on the world stage. Before his death, he was able to impart the lessons he's learned along the way, about life, leadership and love, and to speak candidly about his extraordinary successes, as well as overcoming his failures. On the field, he led some of the finest sportsmen on earth to great victories and heartbreaking defeats, and in the process left his indelible mark on the game. This is a story of lives touched and connections made in the dogged pursuit of excellence. But for Sven, the true journey he wanted to share is the one he made on the inside, the man he became. Because A Beautiful Game is far more than the tale of a successful football manager. It is the story of the biggest game of all, what makes a good life. A story that endures long after the final whistle.
The Eriksson family lived in a flat on Ostmark Road. It had one room and a kitchen, home to my dad, Sven, my mum, Ulla, and later my little brother, Lars-Erik, Lasse. I had to sleep on the kitchen sofa. It was crowded, and Mum dreamt about something larger. Dad didn't think we could afford to move, so he and Mum asked my paternal grandparents to provide a surety for them, so they could borrow money from the bank. Grandpa and Grandma weren't rich, but they owned forests and land, so they could clearly put up a security. But no, we didn't get any help. Mum held a grudge against them after that. There was never a really good relationship between them. That might also have something to do with the fact that, during the first 2 years of my life, they didn't know I existed. I was definitely not planned.
A Beautiful Game by Sven-Göran Eriksson is read by John Sackville and runs for 5 hours and 11 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. And finally on today's show, a return to Fiona Lucas for the books of her life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I think probably the Narnia books. I just loved them because it was kids at the centre and it was so imaginative and transported you to another world and fight of good against evil, and it was just delicious. I was always desperate to find an old wardrobe, as I'm sure most people are, with hanging with fur coats that might have a secret snowy forest behind it.
Lucy ran out of the empty room into the passage and found the other three.
"It's all right," she repeated. "I've come back."
"What on earth are you talking about, Lucy?" asked Susan. "Why," said Lucy in amazement, "haven't you all been wondering where I was?"
"So you've been hiding, have you?" said Peter.
"Poor old Lou, hiding and nobody noticed. You'll have to hide longer than that if you want people to start looking for you."
"But I've been away for hours and hours," said Lucy.
The others all stared at one another.
"Batty," said Edmund, tapping his head. "Quite batty."
"What do you mean, Lou?" asked Peter.
"What I said," answered Lucy. "It was just after breakfast when I went into the wardrobe, and I've been away for hours and hours, and had tea, and all sorts of things have happened."
"Don't be silly, Lucy," said Susan. "We've only just come out of that room a moment ago, and you were there then."
"She's not being silly at all," said Peter. "She's just making up a story for fun, aren't you, Lou? And why shouldn't she?"
"No, Peter, I'm not," she said. It's a magic wardrobe. There's a wood inside, and it's snowing, and there's a fawn and a witch, and it's called Narnia. Come and see." The others did not know what to think, but Lucy was so excited that they all went back with her into the room. She rushed ahead of them, flung open the door of the wardrobe, and cried,
"Now go in and see for yourselves."
"Why, you goose," said Susan, putting her head inside and pulling the fur coats apart. "It's just an ordinary wardrobe. Look, there's the back of it." Then everyone looked in and pulled the coats apart, and they all saw, Lucy herself saw, a perfectly ordinary wardrobe. There was no wood and no snow, only the back of the wardrobe with hooks on it. Peter went in and rapped his knuckles on it to make sure that it was solid.
"A jolly good hoax, Lou," he said as he came out again. "You've really taken us in, I must admit. We half believed you."
That's Michael York reading from The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, book 2 in the Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, as available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you could happily curl up with on a rainy day and reread.
Probably would reread Jane Eyre, which was, again, I think I found that when I was about 13. And I've read it so many times that it's I just love waiting for my favourite bits to come up.
Meantime, Mr. Rochester had again summoned the ladies round him and was selecting certain of their number to be of his party.
Miss Ingram is mine, of course, said he.
Afterwards, he named the two Mrs. Eshton and Mrs. Dent. He looked at me. I happened to be near him, as I had been fastening the clasp of Mrs. Dent's bracelet, which had got loose.
Will you play?
He asked. I shook my head. He did not insist, which I rather feared he would have done. He allowed me to return quietly to my usual seat. He and his aides now withdrew behind the curtain. The other party, which was headed by Colonel Dent, sat down on the crescent of chairs. One of the gentlemen, Mr. Eshton, observing me, seemed to propose that I should be asked to join them. But Lady Ingram instantly negatived the notion.
No, I heard her say. She looks too stupid for any game of the sort.
Ere long, a bell tinkled and the curtain drew up. Within the arch, the bulky figure of Sir George Lynn, whom Mr. Rochester had likewise chosen, was seen enveloped in a white sheet. Before him, on a table, lay open a large book, and at his side stood Amy Eshton, draped in Mr. Rochester's cloak and holding a book in her hand. Somebody unseen rang the bell merrily. Then Adele, who had insisted on being one of her guardian's party, bounded forward, scattering round the contents of a basket of flowers she had carried on her arm. Then appeared the magnificent figure of Miss Ingram, clad in white, a long veil on her head, and a wreath of roses round her brow. By her side walked Mr. Rochester, and together they drew near the table. They knelt, while Mrs. Dent and Louisa Eshton, dressed also in white, took up their stations behind them. A ceremony followed, in dumb show, in which it was easy to recognise the pantomime of a marriage. At its termination, Colonel Dent and his party consulted in whispers for 2 minutes. Then the Colonel called out,
"Bride!"
Mr. Rochester bowed, and the curtain fell.
Amelia Fox, reading from Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. Available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently. It's fresh in the mind, and you'd like to recommend it to the listeners.
I really enjoyed The Housemaid by Freida McFadden. It was just a really good, gripping thriller with a big old twist that I just about guessed before it happened, which made me feel very clever. But I like it when I can't tell where a book's going. And it was just a very satisfying thriller with lots of interest and drama.
If I leave this house, it will be in handcuffs. I should have run for it while I had the chance. Now my shot is gone. Now that the police officers are in the house and they've discovered what's upstairs, there's no turning back. They're about 5 seconds away from reading me my rights. I'm not sure why they haven't done it yet. Maybe they're hoping to trick me into telling them something I shouldn't. Good luck with that. The cop with the black hair threaded with grey is sitting on the sofa next to me. He shifts his stocky frame on the burnt caramel Italian leather. I wonder what sort of sofa he has at home. It sure doesn't cost 5 figures like this one did. It's probably some tacky color like orange, covered in pet fur, and with more than one rip in the seams. I wonder if he's thinking about his sofa at home and wishing he had one like this. Or, more likely, he's thinking about the dead body in the attic upstairs. "So, let's go through this one more time," the cop says in his New York drawl. He told me his name earlier, but it flew out of my head. Police officers should wear bright red name tags. How else are you possibly supposed to remember their names in a high-stress situation? He's a detective, I think.
When did you find the body?
I pause, wondering if this would be the right time to demand a lawyer. Aren't they supposed to offer me one? I'm rusty on this protocol. About an hour ago, I answer.
Why did you go up there in the first place?
I press my lips together. I told you, I heard a sound.
And?
The officer leans forward, his eyes wide. He has a rough stubble on his chin, like he might have skipped shaving this morning. His tongue protrudes slightly from between his lips. I'm not stupid. I know exactly what he wants me to say. I did it. I'm guilty. Take me away.
Instead, I lean back against the sofa.
That's it. That's everything I know.
Disappointment washes over the detective's face. He works his jaw as he thinks over the evidence that has been found so far in this house. He's wondering if he's got enough to snap those cuffs on my wrists yet. He isn't sure. If he were sure, he would have done it already.
Hey, Connors!
It's the voice of another officer. We break eye contact and I look up at the top of the staircase. The other, much younger cop is standing there, his long fingers clutching the top of the banister. His unlined face is pale.
Connors, the younger officer says, you gotta come up here. Now. You gotta see what's up here.
Even from the bottom of the stairs, I can see his Adam's apple bobbing.
You won't believe it.
That's Lauren Allman reading from The Housemaid by Frieda McFadden, available in audio commercially. And once again, Fiona, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. Remember, if you can't wait until our new show next week, there are over 400 back episodes available as a podcast. Just search for R&IB Read On. And remember to listen out for our other show, Talking Books, the best the R&IB Talking Books Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. only on R&IB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on R&IB Connect Radio.